Happy New Year, one and all, and welcome to the very first episode of my film music podcast, Soundtracking of 2020. To celebrate, we've got not one, but two guests for you, with two very different coming-of-age tales about young friendship and rebellion. Both, however, have tremendous warmth at their very core. First up is writer, director and actor Taika Waititi, whose new film Jojo Rabbit tells the story of a boy obsessed by Nazism who discovers his mother is hiding a Jewish girl in the attic. Oh yes, and whose imaginary friend is Adolf Hitler. Then we speak to Brian Welsh about his wonderful celebration of 90s dance culture, Beats, which stars Christian Ortega and Lorne McDonald as two pals getting up for their first outdoor rave. As you'd expect, the soundtrack is an absolute banger. But we begin with Taika and Jojo Rabbit, which is scored by our old friend Michael Giacchino. Now, I must confess to running out of time before we got to talk about what we do in the shadows, which I'm hoping we'll do in sitting number two. But that isn't going to stop me from playing this. It's brilliant intro cue, You're Dead, by Norma Tanaga.
Don't sing if you want to live long. They have no use for your song. You're dead, you're dead, you're dead, you're dead and out of this world. You'll never get a second chance. Plan all your moves in advance. Stay dead, stay dead, stay dead, stay dead and out of this world. Run fast, don't stand in the sun. There's too much work to be done. You're down, you're down, you're down, you're down and out of this world.
Taika, it's a bloody privilege to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me here.
Happy New Year.
Oh,
people
yes.
People will be hearing this, you see, on the 1st of January, right. 2020. So, yeah.
It's a long time to edit this.
So, that's how slow I am or how bad I am. There's so much I want to talk about, Jojo Rabbit being the new film, obviously, but if you don't mind, I want to go back and talk about your other films as well, because music has played a really important part, really differently and specifically for each of those projects.
Yeah.
But let's talk about Jojo. Congratulations. It's
Thank
great.
You.
It's really...
Wonder what, as when this comes out on the 1st of January, I wonder what other stuff will have happened.
I wonder.
You
Father Christmas
say,
will have come.
You could say congratulations on all the stuff that happened in December. Try that.
Congratulations on all the nominees that you got in December, Taika.
Oh, thank you very much. I don't know if they do that in December, but if they do, I'll take it.
Because this film just delivers on so many levels in terms of, you know, we've come to love your comedy and the way that you tell stories with the use of comedy, but there's a wonderful drama to this as well. Is that easy to write? Do you find that those two sides of things easy to write? Does one help the other?
Yeah. Yeah, it's relatively easy to write, but the issue is finding the balance in the editing later on and post-production. So you watch the film and what you thought was like a perfect balance when you wrote the script will turn out to be too heavily weighted towards comedy or irreverence, and then then the audience will tell you, well, it seems like you're just sort of brushing over this issue, or like, you know, or you don't care, or I don't care about the characters because it's just too many jokes. Or it might skew more towards the dramatic side, and then it just feels like every other film like this in the end. So, yeah, so it really is, and it's been the same with all of my films. It's just finding that balance, and that's why I often take quite a long time to edit the films, because I test them all again and again and again and try out different versions and mix things up. So this film took maybe 7 or 8 months to edit, which is it's longer than usual.
Yeah. And you wrote it a long time ago as well,
I wrote
didn't
it in
you?
2011.
Wow.
Yeah. And then I made 3 other movies in the time since writing it to shooting it.
And do you think that experience between writing it and making it, did it change at all? Did the film that you wanted to make back then in 2011 change the film you actually made, do you think?
The script hardly changed at all, but the person who made the film and wrote the script changed. And so I think I'd evolved where my, you know, I think I became more mature. So I can't tell for sure, but I feel like the film I would have made in 2011, 2012 would have been a, I don't know if this is the right word, thinner.
Yeah.
You know, it wouldn't maybe have had as many layers or had the texture that I think this film has.
Yeah.
And that comes from someone, you know, turning 43 and then deciding to make this film as opposed to someone still being in their 30s.
Yeah.
And probably needing a few more life lessons making the film.
I love the way that you write for young people in your films. And
I'm still a baby.
But that's kind of almost kind of because you – I've got two kids, 6 and 11, two boys, and the way they react to things is when you talk to them like a person.
Mm-hmm.
You don't talk to them like they're a kid. And I feel that that's how you write for the young people in your films, that you give them a real voice.
Yeah.
And so I wondered if that was kind of almost you pulling out you as a kid and putting them in those characters in a way.
Yeah, I think you'll find a lot of the kids in my films, they speak a lot, like not in one of those sort of precocious, pretentious ways that sometimes in films, young people, you know, you'll find young people speaking like, yeah, where they're like, they seem overly mature.
Yeah.
It's more my kids think they're more mature and they're not. Whereas I still do that as a grown up. I still pretend I know words so I don't know. Like, you know, someone will say, oh, there's some big word, and I'll nod and I'll go, absolutely.
Oh, yeah. You nailed that.
And then I think, I have to go and Google that word because I still, after 40 years, I don't know what that means, and I've nodded a lot over my life when I've heard that word.
Or I'll just make one up.
Or I'll just make up another word. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
Because all words are made up anyway, so it doesn't matter.
They're all made up. Exactly. So someone had to start with every word. And I like, because, well, you know, and I think if you've seen most of my stuff, the children are usually the roles between children and grown-ups are usually switched. So the children are usually like the sane ones and the ones who are more reliable and who are trying to make sense of the world and trying to, like, I guess, guide themselves and the story through this world. And the grown-ups are this. The grown-ups are usually just bumbling fools who are trying to be cool and they're trying to be liked and they act more like kids than the kids.
You worked with Michael Giacchino on the soundtrack for this film.
Yeah.
Why was he the right man for the job and what were the kind of conversations that you had with him going into him working on it?
Well, Michael Giacchino, as I'm sure you'll be able to list off all of the things he's done, but I guess he grew up with Indiana Jones and the Star Wars films and all of the films that I grew up with. And, you know, and I think that's where he sort of, just like myself, has like drawn from, from that childhood and that the inspirations that you can very clearly hear in a lot of his work comes from that great heritage of uplifting and emotional and adventurous scores that we all grew up with all those great movies in the 70s and 80s. And really, the only conversation we had was, will you do this film and just make it sound like Up? German version of Up.
Thank you.
And there's like a lot, there is part of the suite, the JoJo suite, which really shares a lot with Up, you know. And I think that, you know, and then I realized, oh, there's actually, maybe there's too many similarities in the film itself. Is this this delicate thread through this film with the music that does feel similar to that. So I'd like to think that he was listening to me.
I like that. Because I'd written down, one of the things I'd written down about the score was the kind of, there's the kind of tension to it, but the music box element with sort of dark twists to it, mm-hmm. and kind of spooky strings that kind of come in as well, yeah, which is,
yeah,
kind,
yeah,
of like,
that's right, yeah,
it's a really technical way of describing it,
but yeah, that's how I describe stuff too. So yeah, oh, it needs a bit more of the sort of the fiddly little la-di-di-da thing going through there. What instrument's that? You know, the one that's like in all the other cool movies.
Lovely little moments as well, which you kind of, you know, with the kind of German propaganda music or the records that Rosie's listening to, Scarlett's character and stuff, and mm-hmm. and how you make those decisions on what that is.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of those ones were in the edit, and that's just trial and error. Sometimes it's, you know, the way that we'd played something on set for her to dance to, and the rhythm of how she's moving is just set to this one thing that we had no idea if we could get the rights to or not. And then I think it is the same song, actually. But, yeah, for a minute there, we were like, well, let's try some other stuff. And then it was really hard to find other music that had the same rhythm, and it just looked like she didn't know how to keep a beat. So you know, so that, even that was hard. But, and then the Needle Drops were songs that had been in the script for many years, like right from the very beginning. I had written in the Tom Waits song. also Heroes was in there right from the very first draft. Arthur Lee and Love, that was in there from the beginning.
Everybody's gotta live, and everybody's gonna die. Everybody's gotta live. I think you know the reason why. Sometime I go and get so good that again it gets pretty rough. But when I have you in my arms, baby, you know I just can't get enough.
Quite rare to write those things into a script and actually get to have them. Like, yeah, everyone has those. Yeah, I do it often. I dream and I say, and then we play this. And then
we have Bowie, and we have
music,
Tom White.
And then, yeah. And then the music supervisor usually says, you are dreaming. And then we don't get it. So I was very lucky in that I got those tracks. The original opening track, I can't remember what it was supposed to be. It might have been a Nick Cave song. But then when I was shooting, I just remember like doing some research and watching all this Hitler Youth footage and stuff, and like from a lot of these Nazi rallies, and just struck me how similar the footage of the crowds looked to Beatlemania, with these women crying and fainting and screaming and reaching out for Hitler. And it sort of struck me, oh, wow, he was Germany's rock star. He was the biggest rock star in Europe, if not the world at the time. And what I mean, like, you know, by rock star is just someone who's known. Mm. Someone didn't like him or hate him. Everyone knew who he was. And that's quite phenomenal.
Yeah.
From 1933.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, to have this one personality who is idolized by 50 million people.
Particularly as well when the kind of, when you think, you know, when technology back there in terms of how word spreads about someone, not in the same way that it does now in terms of, you know, in other parts of the world, the message about someone can get there in an instant. But this is kind of boggling to think.
Yeah. And this travels, and there'll be some like small newsreels, but it wouldn't be the same as being able to be really informed. So I guess if you were in the States in 1933, 34, when no one really realized just how dark it was going to get, you'd just think, oh, wow, look at this guy, and everyone loves him. He must be really interesting. There must be something great about him. So I think, you know, even then, and as we all know, you know, there were factions of Nazis in a lot of countries at, you know, throughout the 30s.
So that's why you used the German version of I Wanna Hold Your Hand.
Yeah. Oh, come, come to me. Do not be the best time.
Wrote the script, were you always going to play him?
No. So when I wrote, well, I mean, look at me. Look at my hair.
Perfect.
Look at my face. Look at my skin color. No, that was never on my mind. So I had no real idea who would be playing that. And don't get me wrong, if you've seen my work, you know that I will find a way of crowbarring myself into a movie that I've made. So I don't know how. I don't even know if I thought I could even work out some sort of logical reason for me to be in the movie. Like, oh, maybe if my character's from like Morocco or the Mediterranean accidentally like fell out of a plane and landed in Germany, maybe then, I don't know. There's no real way I ever thought I could be in the film. But then when I got to talking to Fox Searchlight about making it, they, not to the point where they would not have made it, but that was sort of the message I was getting, was that they were only really interested in doing it if I played that character.
Poor Jojo. What's wrong, little man?
Hi, Adolf.
Want to tell me about that rabbit incident? What was all that about?
They wanted me to kill it. I'm sorry. I couldn't.
Don't worry about it. I couldn't care less.
But now they call me a scared rabbit.
Let them say whatever they want. People used to say a lot of nasty things about me. Oh, this guy's a lunatic. Oh, look at that psycho. He's going to get us all killed. I'll let you in on a little secret. The rabbit is no coward. The humble little bunny faces a dangerous world every day, hunting carrots for his family, for his country. My empire will be full of all animals. Lions, giraffes, zebras, rhinoceroses, octopuses, rhinoctopuses, even the mighty rabbit. Cigarette?
Oh, no thanks, I don't smoke.
Let me give you some really good advice. Be the rabbit. The humble bunny can outwit all of his enemies. He's brave and sneaky and strong. Be the rabbit.
That's awesome, though.
It's really great.
Yeah.
Well, I think that, I mean, those guys, maniacs, but also very smart from what, you know, if you see the films that they make. And so I do trust their opinion. And they did make a good point in that if it was like a big A-list celebrity playing that Hitler part, it actually detracts from the main point of the film, which is like about the story of tolerance and understanding and love, you know, between these two kids. And, you know, and what happens instead is then you look, you know, the poster is just a picture of this big actor, and then it becomes the so-and-so Hitler movie as opposed to, oh, here's this movie where it happens to have this goofy imaginary character in it.
Yorkie's an amazing character. I mean, Ricky Baker, I think, has got to be one of my favorite film characters of all time.
That's great.
It was so great to watch that film again this week. It was just, oh, it was extraordinary. Can we talk a little bit about Hunt for the Wilder People?
Yeah.
Because the music in that is, it's so good. And there's a real beautiful mixture of score, but then needle drops. And, you know, and you've got like Leonard Cohen in there, Nina Simone and stuff like that. And is it Monica? Is that the name of the guys that did the score?
Yeah. So Monica.
Lucas, Samuel, and Conrad.
Yeah. So those guys. So Monica actually, under a different name, done the scores for all the films previous to that as well.
Oh, wow.
So under the name, the Phoenix Foundation.
Oh, okay.
So that's those guys. They just decided to change their name for that. I think they were trying to like form a group that specifically only did composition and score.
So
I'd worked with them for years on my films, and they've got a great, I mean, they're a great, like, I don't even know how to describe Phoenix Foundation. Just a great band who use a lot of synthesizers. and I think with that film, I was looking for a real kind of sort of interesting Jean-Michel Jarre sort of soundscape thing, to go through the bush and everything. Yeah. So that's right up their alley. And so we really embraced that stuff. and then the other songs, like some of them were in there for a while, but other ones were found, like the Alessi Brothers. I'm not going to say Freebird because that is a completely different song.
I can't remember which one.
Seabird.
Yes. There you go.
Seabird Fly Home. So, and that was just a discovery from the editor, this guy Tom Eagles, who's really great at finding music. He's got like lots of drives of all the old, you know, like strange things that are either unknown or haven't been known for a long time. And he happened to be trawling through and just found that song, and we put it in. It just seemed, it was just so, so great.
There's a road I know I must go, even though I tell myself that road is closed. Listen, lonely seabird, you've been away from land too long, oh, too long.
So yeah, so I really love all those discoveries that you make in film, you know, where you realize, oh, this here could be a thing. Like, and when we were making Thor, for a long time we had all this William Onyebo stuff in there, which is so weird to have like in a film set in outer space with a space Viking, yeah. But you know, he was in there and everyone loved it, Viking, and then yeah. It just sort of like, you know, just as things evolve, you sort of realize, oh, it doesn't make much sense anymore. and Mother's Bow had done such a great job of like creating all these other pieces that just so happened we decided to stick with him.
Funny because with Mark, I came across Mark through watching this American kids TV show called Yo Gabba Gabba with my kids, and he was like the kind of the session artist. Hey, I'm Mark, and he would like draw a dog, and then it's gone. Who is this guy? He's brilliant. And then I remember speaking to someone, and it was like, oh, Mark Motherbath did this music, and I'm like, hold on, it's the guy that I watch every morning, at like 6 a.m. on Yo Gabba Gabba with my kids.
Yeah, yeah,
he's awesome.
He's amazing. Yeah, and he has a studio in LA, which is like this big circular studio, which is like a UFO. And you sort of walk through there, and he'll be it's just full of old, vintage wooden synths and strange contraptions and instruments. And it's just he's a real artist, and it's quite. Inspiring to go and visit him in his space.
before we talk a bit more about Thor, but there's one thing particular I wanted to talk about, Hunt for the Wilder People, which was the birthday song.
Yeah.
When they sing happy birthday to Ricky. So how
we were shooting the birthday scene, and so Rima, who plays Aunt Bella, she's a musician and a singer, and so and I had this little synthesizer I brought from home, and I said, okay, well, we're going to do this little birthday song, I want you to sing it, and then you do it. And then we did like sort of 8 takes or something, and of traditional happy birthday. And then
it's such a dull song.
And yeah. And then the producer, Carthew, runs in and he comes in. He's like, we're not allowed to use that song. I was like, what are you talking about? And I'd heard this before as well, that it was like, it'd been still under copyright for, however many, 100 years or whatever since someone invented it. And that's since changed. So if anyone's out there listening and wanting to use that in their films, happy birthday.
When's your birthday?
Free.
I can sing it to you now.
No, yeah. That's so we're like, okay, great. So what are we going to do? Well, why don't we make up a birthday song? And so with me and Rima and Julian plays Ricky Baker and Sam, and we just all sort of sat there and sort of spent 20 minutes just figuring out what the lyrics to this thing would be and the changes and everything. And just did that. And so we invented it on the spot in a couple, so, 20 minutes. And I'm so much happier that we did that.
Ricky Baker, now you are 13 years old. You are a teenager and you're as good as gold. Ricky Baker, Ricky Baker, happy birthday, once rejected, now accepted by me and Hector, we're a trifecta. Ricky Baker, Ricky Baker, Ricky Baker, Ricky Baker, Ricky Baker, Ricky Baker, Ricky Baker.
It's such a beautiful moment in the film. It's just, such a simple thing, but it's like, it's kind of just stays with you as well. It's like, it's really, really brilliant. With Thor, was it an easy film to get? You talked about you kind of weaved your way through one and thinking you were going to use one thing and then moving across to the other. Because I think what you did with that film on so many levels helped this whole ending to it as well. Because I was chatting to Christopher and Steven the other night, the writers of the Avengers Endgame and Infinity War. And they were just like, we wouldn't have had these films had it not been for what Taika did with Thor Ragnarok.
All right,
in terms of taking that.
I think with that character, with Chris's, with Thor, and those guys are great because they really, I think by the time we finished Thor, we were in just gone to post, and they had heard what we had done to Thor, and like that we had completely changed him and everything, and they were in the middle of like writing Infinity War and Endgame. And so myself and Brad, the producer of Ragnarok, we flew out to Atlanta to see them and talk about the character and and I sort of would do some passes on the some of the scenes and say, well, this is how if I was writing him for you guys, this is how he would speak and this is the kind of thing he would say, and he's way more irreverent now, and he's like he is a completely different character. But they were very receptive, and they they understood, okay, well, we've got to now change everything with him. And then I think, they already had ideas at the time anyway for this, like, the dude Thor and, later on. And so they're already, I think, like, feeling that anyway. But it was really cool that they listened, I guess. And also Chris he has his own opinions about things, and he brings a lot to the table in terms of that character. And he's an invaluable source, really, when it comes to figuring out what would Thor do, because he knows the character probably more than anyone.
Yeah. What at what point are we going to get a spin-off Krug?
Korg.
Yeah.
Korg, like the keyboard.
Yeah.
I can't predict it. I can't predict when that spin-off, but I can imagine
it's gonna
spawn a whole new universe.
We've watched the kind of Korg's best bits, my kids and I. I mean, we're in triple figures now. They freaking love him.
Awesome.
He's so good.
That's good.
He's such a great character.
Yeah, he's all right. Oh, man, I'm really happy that you guys are such big fans of Korg.
Hey, take it easy, man. Over here, the pile of rocks waving at you. Here. Yeah, I'm actually a thing. I'm a being. Allow me to introduce myself. My name is Korg. I'm kind of like the leader in here. I'm made of rocks, as you can see, but don't let that intimidate you. You don't need to be afraid unless you're made of scissors. Just a little rock, paper, scissor joke for you. This is my very good friend over here, Meek. He's an insect and has nice four hands.
You're a Cronin, aren't you?
That I am.
How'd you end up here?
Oh, well, I tried to start a revolution but didn't print enough pamphlets, so hardly anyone turned up, except for my mum and her boyfriend, who I hate. As punishment, I was forced to be in here and become a gladiator. Bit of a promotional disaster, that one. But I'm actually organising another revolution. I don't know if you'd be interested in something like that. Do you reckon you'd be interested?
For the end of the film, you know, in terms of, like, that's what I think's brilliant is the way that you just, I don't know, you kind of almost reminded the whole Marvel lot to not take themselves too seriously of that kind of, you know, that ending of going, oh, it's all right, guys, you know, the foundations, and then, you know,
yeah,
and that.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
Then it's like, oh, and but it's like to have the balls to that.
Yeah, no, those foundations are gone, I'm sorry. Yeah. And that's also a testament to Kevin Feige, who's, you know, like he's got a very, very receptive mind. He just, you know, he's always looking for something different. Something that feels like it's a thing he hasn't seen before. Mm. And so all that stuff I was just doing on set just to screw around, really, was like, because I knew my character was CG, they could just shut me up at any time. So, like, I was just standing there just, like, staring out the window with everyone just talking and just saying, yep, now we can always, you know, rebuild this place and it's going to be a haven for all sorts of – all creatures from all around the universe. And then – But so there was never an intention, A, for that to be in the film, but also for even for my accent to be in the film.
Really?
No, there was just like, I was like, okay, well, I'm going to do this, and I guess we'll figure it out later in post, like how he really sounds. And then, but Kevin was like, okay, I love that.
It's genius.
Let's just keep it in.
It's genius.
I thought he was nuts, but like, I was really happy he did.
Yeah. And the marriage as well of the way that that film was kind of, you know, before it was released with that, with the use of that. The Immigrant Song and Led Zeppelin as well. Talk about a brilliant marriage of everything. It was just kind of like, just hit you like a ton of bricks. It's so
great. Yeah, it's bombastic and it's really unapologetic as well. I really love, that they let me do a lot of that stuff because it is very, it's actually very Thor. If you read the comics, it's in your face and like there's just constantly just new weird elements that don't really have any business being in a film or in a comic, but just somehow altogether they do make sense. Like if you think about, you know, if you think about the poster or all the elements in Thor, it's a woman with antlers fighting a space Viking. There also happens to be a giant wolf and a zombie army and a giant green muscly guy and a drunk woman who used to be in a full female army and a guy made of rocks and an insect person and also Jeff Goldblum and then lots of really bright spaceships and basically
– And a hammer.
Like, yeah, and a hammer. So basically it's – you just – you know, it's like asking – a bunch of six-year-olds, what would you like in a movie? And then just saying yes to everything.
And we wouldn't want it any other way. Thanks for your time. It's a real pleasure to get to chat to you. And,
my pleasure.
And I look forward to what's next as well. Thanks, Tyke. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank Cheers. You so much. Yeah, nice to meet you. I'll see you. Bye.
Drive our ships to new land. Fight the whole.
From the soundtrack to Thor Ragnarok, that is, of course, Immigrant Song by Led Zeppelin, rounding off the first part of this bumper New Year soundtracking with Taika Waititi. Jojo Rabbit is on general release now, and I thoroughly recommend it. Next up, something for the ravers, as I talk to Brian Welsh about his joyous indie homage to 90s dance music culture, Beats, which is available on Homence formats now. Set in 1994 in Scotland against the backdrop of the Criminal Justice and Public Order Act, tells the story of best friends Jono and Spanner as they get ready to party. Scored by the golden filter duo of Penelope Traps and Stephen Hindman, Beats also features numerous classic anthems from the era, including Song of Life by Left Field. Welcome to Soundtracking. It's an absolute treat to have you on. I'm such a fan of Beats. Congratulations on that film.
Thanks, Edith.
So I just want more people to see it.
Good.
Yeah. I know that it's based on Kieran's play,
yeah,
that you co-wrote the screenplay with him on that.
Yeah.
What was it about the story and about these characters that you connected with, I guess, or just wanted to kind of take that journey on further?
Sure. Well, I, you know, grew up in the 90s in Scotland, and rave parties and techno parties were definitely part of my coming of age, if you like, and I've been trying to develop a script set in that world for a while, and, you know, failing. And then a friend of mine says, oh, you need to go along and see this young man's play that's, yeah, happening at the Bush Theatre in London. And I went along, and Kieran was doing this one-man performance where it was just him sat at a desk with a microphone, a DJ, Johnny Whoop DJing, mm-hmm, and a screen behind him playing all these rave visuals. And it was just a hugely intoxicating and moving experience. And I just kind of fell in love with Kieran that night and asked him if he wanted to be my pal and develop the play into a screenplay. And so we met up a few times after that, and eventually, you know, Camilla Bray came on as producer, and so we just worked tirelessly, you know, taking this one-man performance and adapting it for, yeah, a 90-minute screenplay.
What do you think it is about that music scene and that particular era that has this kind of connection? Like, you know, you kind of, you say you watch this, and I imagine that a lot of the connection you had that night was that
was the music and the way that you, I mean, tell me, is it, you know, bringing back memories or feelings or all that kind of stuff?
I think it's just that thing of, like, you know, young people gathering en masse together and there being this communal energy in the room and that being something that's really, really powerful and transformative. And, you know, the story takes place in 1994 when you've had years of Tory government and, you know, this sort of isolationism built in conservative values. But then, you know, you have young this subculture that's railing against those values and young people gathering en masse to this crazy repetitive music and, and dancing tribally. And, you know, it wasn't necessarily initially a political movement, but there's something sort of inherently political in that, and that felt key to me. It was something Kieran really nailed in the play, was setting that story of John Owen Spanner in that context.
Yeah,
you know?
It's because the way the film opens with the 94, you know, the Criminal Justice Act, and it's like that, oh yeah, you get a sense already of kind of, you're with them.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? You kind of feel like, I'm on your side.
Yeah, well, there's, you know, the figures of authority trying to kind of stop them having fun. Like,
totally. Your cast in this, I mean, there's so much to talk about the film. We'll get onto the music in a second, but Christian and Lorne taking on these two brilliant characters and this kind of wonderful thing that are, you know, coming from a wee fishing village in Scotland kind of thing, those those relationships that you form and those different paths that you kind of take for different reasons and things are it's such a beautiful friendship story.
Yes.
You know, in terms of these lads who kind of just love each other.
Aye.
But the pools of what's taken them in different kind of routes and stuff as well. Was it easy to find your Spanner and Jono?
Oh man, we must have seen every kid in Scotland that wanted to act, to be honest. It was like we really, really did. We spent a long time in casting, and Lorne came in quite early on and read for Jono initially. And he came back a few times, and I thought, you know what, he might be—he's quite a big, you know—he's got this sort of gangly humour about him. And so we asked him to come back and read for Spanner, and we knew then, oh, we've nailed that.
Yeah.
The challenge then was trying to find his buddy, his best pal, and coincidentally, Lauren and Christian studied together, and they're best mates in real life. And Christian was away at that time; he was doing a play in Texas. And,
oh wow!
And so it was literally about a week before we were going to shoot. We're pulling our hair out by this point, and he says, "Oh, my mate Christian's coming back for Texas soon. Do you want to get him into the room?" And he came in, and then immediately that chemistry that we were hoping to spend weeks in rehearsal developing was just instantly there, and that was obviously a gift to us.
This summer's gonna go off, me and you, right?
The Criminal Justice and Public Order Bill. You heard about this? They're going to make it illegal to have gatherings around music wholly or predominantly characterised by the emission of a succession of repetitive beats.
Hear this one?
Aye, mate, aye.
You like it?
It's bouncing, man.
Turn it up.
Everybody is in the place. Everybody is in the place. Everybody is in the place.
Who are you speaking to?
Nobody.
Hello, Colin. It's about Jono. He won't be coming in today. He's dead. Aye, we're off your gutted, like. I'll pass that on.
They want us to get in line, but we won't. They want us to be afraid of each other, but we're not.
That boy dragged you down.
Just you try and stop us all.
Lawlessness
prevails, people become a danger to themselves.
He's a really proper best pal,
sir. I'll see you on the other side then, mate.
One thing I want to touch on might be a weird question was, because obviously, I mean, I imagine I'm similar ages with you, and so that whole time I have such kind of fond memories, particularly because I was in Edinburgh at the time at university, and so kind
Go
of
to Pure.
Oh my God, yeah, Carberry Voltaire, City Calf, and all that kind of. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
So it's like I remember as well there being some kind of brilliant rave down on the beach down somewhere where you could see the Forth Road. You're in between the two bridges, just down on the beach. It was amazing. So that kind of, you know, you hear those tunes, you know, that Enjoy track, particularly for me, is just kind of like, oh my God! And I'm instantly transported back there. For these two, they're of a different generation.
Yeah.
And I wondered if it was something you spoke to them about in terms of, did they have a similar thing at all when they were growing up, of a music scene that had this kind of power over them, or there was this kind of, you know, that kind of communal thing of kind of coming together at festivals or all that kind of
yeah,
thing?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think, you know, they both, well, JD Twitch, who one half of Optimal, who did the music, you know, he still plays in Glasgow and,
yeah,
and Edinburgh every week, and they both loved that music,
yeah,
already. I mean, obviously the film introduced them to a whole bank of new stuff,
yeah,
but you know, I think young people still go out and have those same experiences, albeit it's in a kind of more licensed commercial venues.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah,
yeah.
Where did you start with the music for it? Because obviously there was a precedence there with the stage play, and,
yeah,
and how Kieran had brilliantly kind of, you know, worked the music as part of the narrative sort of thing. But when you were thinking about and writing the script together, how did you sort of work out, A, what songs you were going to use, where the music would fit, but then also working on a score side of things as well?
Yeah, sure. So we, some of the tracks that were in the play made it into the film, like Dominator, the moment when the police come in and don't, you know, you got the wild kind of sirens of Dominator playing. That we always knew that was going to be part of it, and luckily it's a big track for Twitch as well, so he was totally sold on that.
Wanna kiss myself. Wanna kiss myself. Wanna kiss myself. Wanna kiss myself. I'm bigger and bolder and rougher and tougher. In other words, sucker, there is no other. I'm bigger and bolder and rougher and tougher. In other words, sucker, there is no other.
But in terms of the process with Twitch, I had a whole bank of archive material from back in the day. There was a crew called Desert Storm who used to put on free parties, and they used to film the parties so that if the police showed up, they would say, oh, we're making a music video. That was kind of the excuse.
Amazing.
And so we had all of this stuff, and so I made this like 90-minute cut, which had something of the kind of shape of the film in terms of its energy. And then Twitch did some like live jams to that, and so a lot of the music from there became embedded in the script, and then we also did an animatic of the film and really honed in on the tracks that we wanted to use. So when it came to shooting the rave, we had quite a lot of those.
So you had to have that organised in advance then, I imagine.
Yeah, and we also wanted to record the music in the space live, so when you watch it, it's not all like post-synced, it's yeah. all like actually recorded in the yeah. space, so you've got the textures of the crowd and all of that stuff. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Was that easy to do?
It was terrifying.
Was it?
Yeah, because we were like, okay, you know, the reason that most party films look a bit rubbish in films is because you start the music, you get all the background dancing, and then you stop the music, they pretend dance, and then you record the dialogue. But we were like, no, we're going to put on a real rave with 1,000 people, and we'll just work Amazing. Our way around the crowds. And it, yeah, it is a risk, because you want everyone to come in 90s clothes, you want the dancing to be like authentically 90s.
Yeah.
And we're just really, I mean, we had such a great crew that we're really lucky that it all came together. But, you know, we blew most of the budget on that night, so if it hadn't worked...
The best party in the world.
And if it hadn't
it's
worked...
It's like having the rap party before you've even yeah, started
yeah,
filming.
Yeah, exactly. The police even showed up at the end.
Did
to
they?
To shut us down. Yeah.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, yeah.
But you had the cameras, so you were
yeah,
like,
right,
we're,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
we're
exactly.
not filming a music video, we're filming a film. That's amazing.
Yeah.
And but what about in terms of like kind of, you know, you had to kind of almost, I guess, sort of put a stamp on those tracks that you were going to use within that environment and stuff. Was it easy to get all that clearance and all that kind of stuff as well? Because that's a whole other world, isn't
well,
it?
Well, I need to give a big shout out to Phil Canning, who worked tirelessly going around parties and, you know, schmoozing people. And very luckily, the Prodigy came on board right at the beginning, you know, for something that was reasonable and we could do for a small indie film. And
yeah.
then after that, it was much easier to then go to whoever it was, Richie Houghton or Carl Craig, and say,
yeah.
you know, well, the Prodigy are in.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, yeah. A couple of people have had that similar thing. We spoke to this brilliant first-time film director, and she'd, I think it was REM she'd managed to get.
Wow.
And then it was, no, it was, I'll tell you what, it was Sam Taylor-Johnson
right.
with her Own Little Pieces, and she managed
okay.
to get Smashing Pumpkins because they liked the script and
oh,
they loved the
nice,
book.
Nice.
And then it was like, if you've got Smashing Pumpkins, then... You know, it's like, come on, they've done it
yeah,
for
yeah,
like
yeah.
that. You can't sort of start charging.
It's
up.
Also about having someone manage to get those, you know, have that relationship
yeah.
and get there. And that's what Phil was really good at, yeah.
I mean, Prodigy was such an important part of that whole scene anyway, do you
yeah.
know what I mean? So you kind of, it's like they're almost a character within it, aren't they,
yeah.
in terms of like, they were so sort of present at that time.
First album for me is just like I still listen to that all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
How much are you using the film, do you think, or your experience?
Probably a bit more than I'd like to admit, to be honest.
Until now.
I mean, like that scene that happens in the phone box, that actually happened to me.
Oh man. That's a lovely thing to document, though. Do you know what I mean? It's like, and I think that that's where there's so much heart in this film. It's so emotional. It really, really is. And I think that that's because it's kind of, it's come from truth. It's come from a real place and real experiences as well.
And Kieran's writing, you know, we had so much fun doing the dialogue. And, you know, it feels like it's coming from real Scottish voices.
Yeah.
And I think that the boys did really good at carrying that off. You know?
Did you encourage like improvisation with it, or was it more you kind of sticking to script?
We stuck to the script a lot. I mean, we shot quite a lot more. You know, we shot quite a lot more. But we were, you know, in rehearsals we were doing a lot of improvisation, but we kept coming back to the script, and I think that's, you know, testament to sort of the hard work that Kieran and I put into it. You know?
And what about kind of, you know, that music that's not those tracks within it and stuff, and how did you navigate that, and how did you know that you needed that and where you needed that?
Do you mean the score?
Yes.
Well, it was clear during the edit that we were needed to find something that was more written to picture, and that was really connected to the boys' friendship and their story and their heart and the love story really between the two of them. So we worked with the Golden Filter, who Keith suggested he'd worked with them a bit, Penelope and Stephen, and they just captured something really subtle but nuanced and quite beautiful, I think. And it was a combination of using some of those sounds that you associate and instrumentation that you associate with techno music, but also with piano and a bit more emotion, I think.
Yeah. Did you give them the script to read and then, or had you shot stuff and showed them kind of rough edits and stuff?
They came on, we'd cut picture by that point, and we'd been temping with a few little things. And
do you mind me asking what?
Oh.
It's always quite interesting because there's a kind of temp music has this whole thing where sometimes composers hate it because sometimes directors can you just do me something that's a bit like this?
Yeah, no, or we didn't do that. Yeah. I mean,
but it's a good way of working out what works and what doesn't, isn't it?
I can't remember. It was a real mix of things. And some of the tracks were like classical pieces that we'd slowed right down.
Yeah.
And when I say slowed down, I mean like thousands percent.
Yeah.
And so they took on this sort of drony but string-based quality. Yeah.
Barry Jenkins has got this great thing that he used called Chopped and Screwed.
Oh, yeah.
Where he kind of like sort of takes like a Fleetwood Mac is a big one that you kind of slow it right down and you just like distort it and mess with it. And it's kind of such a clever way of still getting the emotion of a particular piece of music, but messing with it in a way that you kind of almost like can't quite recognise it.
Oh, so he does that as well, does he?
Yeah, he did that Moonlight. That's
interesting.
Yeah. It's a whole scene, apparently. Like, I think the origins of it are down in Florida, where he grew up, sort of thing. It was a big thing that was done within the hip hop scene down there, and all that kind of stuff as well. Okay. So it was like, oh, I like that when I learned something new about little tricks of the trade and stuff like that.
No,
as well.
I think it was Rob, the editor, that suggested it. Yeah,
it's good.
Aye,
because it's that thing. Recommendations are such a big thing as well, particularly with people that you trust and that you're working with as well. And I don't know, when you're so involved in something, when you're writing it, when you're directing it, and then to have a kind of different pair of eyes coming in and thinking, well, that could work, you know. So looking at Penelope and Stephen as being, did he talk to you what he thought was the, why he thought they were right for it?
They just kind of, we talked a lot about what we wanted from it emotionally, and then it was just one of those things of like batting things backwards and forwards. And quite often when you're writing score, you know, a piece, you know, you think that a piece of music's right for one scene, but it can feel a bit on the nose, but it still captures something about the essence of the spirit of what you're doing. And then, you know, you move that to the first act instead of the third act, and it's like, oh, bang, then that works. So it's always an organic thing, particularly in the edit.
Thank you.
Have you had much feedback from the artists that you've used in the film in terms of the film as a whole? And that scene, because it's held with such love, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Sort of adoration for...
A little bit. I mean, we heard that Liam from The Prodigy liked the film, so that was
nice.
That was pretty cool. And
not that you're making it for the artist in the film, but because it's
I mean, it meant a lot to me to know that they felt, because they felt that we'd done something truthful and honest,
yeah.
And that captured it. There's a whole kind of, I don't even know if Orbital have seen it yet, but the way that they came to the film was quite funny, because a friend, we'd put Belfast on, and then a friend of ours, for some reason we couldn't get it cleared, but a friend of ours, Russ from Aberdeen, had given the Orbital guys a kazoo, which a night they had in Aberdeen back in like 1987 or 88 when they just started out, and this kazoo had ended up on the sleeve for Belfast. They took a picture of the kazoo and put it on the sleeve for Belfast.
Oh my God.
And then sent it to him and said, here's your kazoo on the album. And so 25 years later he tapped them and said, remember that favour that I gave you, the kazoo? Any chance we can use your track in this film that I've been helping out
with? Did they say yeah?
They actually re-recorded Belfast for us because we couldn't get it cleared, so they did us a special one-off.
Amazing.
Which I think's on the CD soundtrack.
Yeah, the soundtrack's incredible. Yeah. If there's anybody who kind of wants a deep dive in a brilliant kind of way to that whole scene, the soundtrack for the film is just extraordinary.
Thanks.
Oh, it's so good. Was that fun to put together as well?
Really good fun. And, you know, I really love Keith Twitch. And, you know, again, it was one of those things we just must have listened to, you know, 2,000 pieces of music. And you're always just trying to distill down to the essence of what you're doing, and it was good. And you know, we wanted the film to feel like a mixtape in a funny kind of way, so there's a lot of like tracks playing over each other and samples and loops, and it's got a bit of an acid techno mixtape feel to it, you know.
So good. Reminds me of what we used to, when I used to work at the St Stephen Street Bar in Edinburgh, when we'd be in on a Sunday morning, probably coming straight to work,
right,
and putting like almost having continuing the sort of night out before everybody came in, sort of getting the table set up. That's what I was listening to. Exactly that. What's next? Do you know?
I'm working with Camilla and Kieran. We're developing a couple of treatments at the moment. So,
great.
You know, try to write something that's hopefully will get made. Oh. And hopefully come January, we'll have, well, three treatments really. And
that's exciting.
We'll make a decision which one we're going to take the script stage.
Yeah. How is Black Mirror as well? Because we've had quite a few people on who've worked on kind
Black
of,
Mirror.
Yeah. What was that experience like?
God, it's so long ago now. But I was
I did
the very first season.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. So when it was still at Channel 4.
Yeah.
And I was just out of film school, and it was like,
bloody hell, that's an amazing thing to get straight out.
Yeah,
I mean, it wasn't what it is now, but what it did back then is why it became what it is now.
Yeah, totally.
I mean,
and it felt like we were doing something, you know. It was quite early on and prophetic in so many ways. When you think of, I did the episode with the memory grain, where you know, you play back the memories into the eye, and it was before Google Glasses and before Facebook Timeline. And Charlie is really, he really has a funny, weird way of being able to see what's coming in the future with technology. And it was great. You know, it was like making a film, but, you know, like a shorter format, yeah. And, you know, working with Toby Kebbell and Jodie Whittaker, and we just treated it like we were making a film. And that was a really good training ground for me in terms of, like, because I was an editor before that. I'd done a film at film school, mm-hmm. called In Our Name, but I was an editor before that, and so, you know, I started to learn about lenses and things like that. And, you know,
what a technical stuff.
What a jib is and a best boy and all that, you know.
And then I guess, having that experience as an editor, though, music was very much part of that world, because the edit is the kind of, you know, the sort of, it's where that marriage of those two things is really solidified, really, isn't it?
Totally. I'm a frustrated musician, really. Like, that was really where I always wanted to be. Yeah. And then editing, I guess, a lot of the principles of, like, mixing music just dovetail perfectly with cutting picture and sound.
Amazing. Beats, I just think it's such a beautiful and clever and funny and just poignant and great film. So great to have you on to talk about it, Brian. Thank you.
That means a lot
much.
Coming for you. Thank you.
Oh, bless. Thanks, Brian. Cheers, mate. Okay. Thank you. Soundtrack to Brian Welsh's Beats, that's track 4 by LFO, concluding the very first soundtracking of a new decade. My huge thanks to Brian and Taika Waititi for taking the time to talk to us. That's a lot of tease. Jojo Rabbit is in cinemas now, with Beats available to stream through various channels at your leisure. We also wanted to say a special thanks to Penelope and Stephen from The Golden Filter, who sent us their as yet unreleased cues from the score to Beats, without which, well, we'd have been in a bit of a pickle. Head to edithbowman.com or your preferred podcast provider to catch up with all of our previous episodes, and please do subscribe whilst you're there. Keep up with the latest news by following us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at SoundtrackingUK. Next up, thoroughly excited to bring you my chat with the wonderful Sam Mendes. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.